It's Current State for Thursday. Welcome, I'm Mark Bayshore. Among parts of Michigan affected by flood warnings, the Maple River in Clinton County, just north of us here at WKAR, flood warnings remain in effect for the river at Grand Rapids, the Grand River at Grand Rapids, and several other parts of Kent County, Saginaw River in Saginaw County. Some other warnings have been downgraded to advisories with waters actually receding in some areas. And in the meantime, if you are the kind of person who cannot get enough skiing, if you know such a person, MLive reports Boyne Mountain will be open this weekend for skiers. It reports it's the first time there's been April skiing at Boyne Mountain in 16 years. 25 trails should be open. What a state. We have an interesting show here for you today. The NFL draft is later on. We'll talk with an author of a book about the Detroit Lions, 100 Things Lions Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. We're talking transportation in Michigan later in the hour as well. But first, a memorable edition of 60 Minutes from back in 2011 reported that banks across the nation had used forged signatures to process foreclosure documents. Later, Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette launched an investigation that found that more than 1,000 unauthorized and improperly executed documents were filed with county registers of deeds throughout the state. Those documents were prepared by a company named DocX, which was identified in the 60 Minutes show. Now, after reaching a $2.5 million civil settlement with the parent company of DocX, efforts against mortgage fraud are continuing. Earlier this month, Macomb County launched a first-in-the-nation high-tech mortgage database, what they call the Super Index, to help homeowners and homebuyers fight fraud. Joining us today, Macomb County Register of Deeds Carmela Sabaugh, who leads the development of the system, and Ingham County Register of Deeds Curtis Hertel, Jr. Carmela, good morning.
Oh, good morning to you.
Curtis Hertel, nice to see you again, too.
Always nice to see you, Mark.
Carmela, first, tell us about the fire. I guess you're contending with the fallout from a fire at some of your county offices in Macomb. What happened, and how are you getting by?
Well, you know something. We had probably one of the oldest buildings in Macomb County. It's a 1930 building that we were housed there. And not only were we there, we had our finance department, our HR department, our IT department. So all of the wires and cabling and everything was in that building. They did not have an off-site, disaster recovery area. And so what happened when the fire broke, it was a fire because of water coming in at the pipe. Obviously, they were looking for anywhere where they could put the wires years ago because those old buildings did not have, access to something like the technology we have today.
Okay.
So anyhow, they put the wires in there, water came in there, and then there was an electrical fire. And so we were on the second floor, all of our equipment. We had to relocate to a building that doesn't have any phones, and the phone line is not connected to our county phone. And so anyhow, so we had to move the registers over there. We're just unpacking some of our equipment now. Our company, our partner company, ACS Xerox, they shipped us all new equipment, and we were waiting for the AT&T line because of the direction from our IT department, and that's where we're at now. We're going to get one of those UVerse lines in there. We do have off-site for our Register of Deeds, and we are proud of that office, and we're really proud to present this Super Index and tell you how wonderful it was working with our vendor, ACS, Xerox, and Google. We had a relationship with Google, and the way we had that relationship, the county was trying to get a new email, access. And one of the people in my office, Todd Schmitz, a lot of people know who he is, and he's the kind of a person who gets onto something and doesn't let it go till we get it completed. Anyhow, we are using the email with Google, and so Google was up. And so we had other things that we did with Google. They had recognized us as a government transformer because we use a lot of their products.
Let's back up just a little bit, though, and just start at the beginning here for people who haven't heard about this. How does, in real basic terms, how does the Super Index work, and who is it for?
Okay, the Super Index really is for anyone who is searching records. It is an easy way to do it, and that was one of the things that we thought after listening to that 60-minute TV show, that when someone was doing robocalls, these banks were doing these fraudulent signatures with Linda Green, is how can you find out how many that did come into your county? There's no way we could do that except by going document by document. This system, the Super Index, everything is OCR'd, which means that it's an optical where they character recognition, where they where they gather all of that, because otherwise you're limited to your index, what was indexed. So this way, for the public, they can look up, and let's face it, your home is your castle. I mean, everyone, that's the American dream, is to own the home. And really what happened during that mortgage fraud was so detrimental to all of our people. And they can go online and now, and if you pulled up Linda Green, you would find how many we would have in this county, fraudulent signatures. But there was a real person in Macomb County named Linda Green. This index will help title companies. It'll help the public, the mom and pop who, everyone, honestly, I think just about everyone knows how to search with Google. It's easy. It's it's very fast,
and that's the heart of it right there, is the search capability. You go to Macomb here, for our listeners who might want to see what we're talking about.
Sure.
The URL is macomb.govrcd.com. macomb.govrcd.com. They go to that website, they can plug in a name, and you will end up being led to every document in the county files with that name on it.
That's right. And we've had over 7 million records, and we've had all of them OCR'd, and all of them can, the Super Index can get to them.
Okay. And this is a first in the nation thing. There's no
Absolutely.
Other county in the nation that is doing this.
Really, and I really do think because of that, the fraud that happened with the banks, and because I think Hertel can speak to that, as far as, because I think he did enter into a lawsuit, against them. We didn't. We did something a little different, but anyhow, I think any time that you have, risk for your property records, it's not good. And if this can cut it down a little bit, we'd be very happy about that.
Sure. Well, we're on a last-name basis here. Hertel, what do you make of this?
I'm sorry.
You guys
know
each other.
I know so many Hertels. I'm sorry. I know his father, his uncle.
You two are acquainted, correct?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And it's a very good family, a very good political family, by the way. And
Curtis, what do you make of this?
I commend Macomb County and Carmella for what they're doing. I think that property fraud is the fastest growing white collar crime in America. Michigan is one of the top 10 states where it happens. So it's not just foreclosure fraud in general. In Ingham County, we've found ways to handle it. We've started indexing more information on documents once the fraud started happening. We have a property fraud alert system. People can go to propertyfraudalert.com. Give us their name, email address, and anything.
That's a county thing?
Yeah.
Propertyfraudalert.com is an Ingham County thing.
It's a Ingham County thing through a separate vendor.
Okay.
I think there are five or six counties in the state that have it. But you go on, you give us your name and your address, and then anytime anything's ever found in the records that it's filed with your name in it, you get an email or telling you about it. But I'm definitely very interested in this. It sounds like could be very helpful in the process. I can tell you that having staff go through looking for Linda Green documents was a nightmare.
By hand, yeah.
We were going through, and we believe we found them all, But it took us, you know, a good couple weeks to do it, and this would obviously make it faster.
I can imagine. What security issues did you deal with, Carmela, and how does security in general work with the Super Index working with Google like this?
No, it's all through our ACS Xerox system, you know, and the Google search, they're tied in together with that.
Okay.
So it's as secure as our records are secure here, and that's part of it. And we've been on the internet with land access, and we still have land access, you know, up there. And we wanted an easier way to search, because once if you're looking for something like Curtis was saying, that you know there's all kinds of fraud, and this can help with all kinds, because people can check their record, they can look on there, and I, you know, commend him for stepping out and really starting a lawsuit against them, because that really needed to happen. And I think that as long as we're vigilant as Register of Deeds and elected officials, we can have a bigger impact on this.
Curtis, do you think your job and other registers of deeds jobs are going to be, is this the cutting edge of change as to how your job gets done?
I mean, I think OCR technology has made it amazing to actually pick up more and more data. You know, the ability for a computer to scan something and actually read it. I mean, it's intelligent recognition is very impressive. So we have different vendors. Carmela's with ACS. I'm with Fiddler Technologies. They're both on the cutting edge of stuff. So I plan on talking to my vendor and seeing exactly what partnerships they could make to make things like this happen as well.
Carmela, how badly was Macomb County hit by mortgage fraud?
You know something, it's one of those we've had, it's kind of one of those invisibles, so you don't really know that it's happening until it happens. And we've had so many foreclosures, and you know, as far as the number, I don't really have a number. But I know that people are very concerned about it, and a lot of times with that, you know, with the people signing those fraudulent mortgages, I think that was the biggest impact, the fraudulent mortgages. And to think that the banks could, that these companies could do that, and with no accountability of what they were doing, is just despicable, really.
I hope I don't sound like I'm belaboring this, but there are around 3,000 counties in the United States. How do you know you're leading the nation with this?
Well, you know something, we know because we had certainly with Google and the vendor that we have ACS, they service all around the country, and Google has a large, you know, group of people that they serve too. So we are in a, if somebody, you know, says that they have it, then let's hear it. Give us a shout out.
any privacy issues, Carmela Sabaugh?
No, I mean, we are on the internet with public records anyhow. That is a public record that you have to put out there. So we've redacted we have redacted all of the Social Security numbers that was done prior to this. We have in Macomb County, and really thanks to the legislature quite a few years ago, they had every record that is recorded, the county register gets a $5 that they have to use for technology. And we cannot spend it on employees, we cannot spend it on any other office, just for technology within the register's office. So that's how we were able to do a lot of these things that we are doing. And this will pay for itself, because when people search, and you've got to try it. I mean, and I know Curtis has already tried it, and you just have to do it. And it, you can pay for it. You will get what you need. You don't have to scroll through a whole lot. You can actually get right to the document if you have certain information on it.
What was your experience with it, Curtis or Tell?
It works well.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's similar to our software, except for there's just more data points that are available. I think that's really what interesting thing about what Google has done is that they've made it so there's more data points. So, for example, we don't code addresses. So people have to have legal descriptions or names, because that's historically how properties have moved over time. Addresses change, legal descriptions don't.
Mm-hmm.
That's how most land records offices are throughout the state. This would pick up the address, for example. So that's a very interesting and good thing.
Curtis, you're the head of the statewide Association of Registers of Deeds. Is the word getting out about Macomb's system, and are people exploring it?
I haven't had a meeting since the press came out last week, but we are having our summer conference in Mackinac, and I'm sure it'll be a big discussion there.
Carmela Sabaw, are Macomb residents taking to the system? Do you know they're using it?
Yes, absolutely. We've had a lot of the area people, definitely the different attorneys in the area, the different, and I have some beautiful quotes by these people. They're excited about it. We have had it out there for them to search with, and that's why we just recently, within the last few months, actually rolled it out. But the public loves it because a Google search, how easy is that? You know, and then they can look at all of the things, you know, what they're looking for, if they're looking for a lien, if they're looking for whatever they're looking on that record. And you're right, we cannot index all of the different functions that they can pick up from the, after they've OCR'd something. We're excited about it. And we had, here's one of the things from Clark and Anderson, Andrews from O'Reilly's, one of the big law firms in Macomb County, and he says the new Macomb County Register of Deeds Super Index is much faster and easier to use than our other, we have land access. If you use Google, you'll like the Super Index and try it now. And everyone has to try it, I think. Try it, and really, I think it's going to, and you can never tell how much something's going to be used, but it was well received, and I think it is true. Each county has their own vendor that they work with, and we have worked with ACS Xerox for years. When I first came in this office back 20 years ago.
We're gonna have to move on, Carmela. I do appreciate this very much. Been very enlightening. Macomb.govrcd.com. Carmela Sabaw is the Register of Deeds for Macomb County. We've been talking about the Super Index with her and with Ingham County Register of Deeds, Curtis Hertel Jr. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you. Always nice talking to you, Carmela.
You. Bye now.
Yes, sounds like NFL Films music to me. Joe Schmidt, Yale Larry, Alex Karras, Lem Barney, just a few of the legendary names and stories in the 2012 book, 100 Things Lions Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. It's a collection of Detroit Lion history by Oakland Press sports writer Paula Pash. Pash reflects on everything from the team's Ohio roots as the Portsmouth Spartans through the championship teams of the 1950s to great and not so great draft picks in Lions years past. With the NFL draft just hours away, WKAR's Peter Wharf talks with Paula Pash about draft choice booms and busts, beginning with the Lions' first round pick from Oregon.
Second down now for Harrington. Short drop, fire slant, caught, first down.
I think the fans are quite aware. You know, Joey Harrington was he was just not a fit from the get-go, and they tried to make him fit, and he was a Matt Millen guy all the way. I don't think, from what I've heard, the whole team was in favor of that pick, but he was, and Joey was a third overall pick. I mean, that's pretty high, and they never really got, they never got a winning season out of him.
And the pass is complete. Rodgers races to the end zone.
Charles Rogers, he had a substance abuse problem, and he had a couple of broken collarbones, and he could just never get his life turned around off the field, and they cut him. He was the first round pick. He was second overall in 2003, and they cut him in 2006. I mean, he just never was able to make much of a contribution, and I mean, it was just a lousy lousy pick. He had a history. They should have known. And then the other one was the other wide receiver, Mike Williams. And I was at the Lions facility the night of that, or the day of that, the draft in Mike Williams. And I practically remember everyone in the media's jaws dropping when they announced that pick, because he was 10th overall.
Right.
This was back in 2005. He had been out of football for a year. No one projected him that high, and for good reason. I mean, he just never was a fit. He never came through. It was, there was so many other good players that they could have had, and you know, they instead went with Mike Williams. And that's three picks that were just totally, totally wasted. And you can thank Matt Millen for all three of them.
You're listening to Current State. This is Peter Wharf. I'm talking with Paula Pasch, the Oakland Press sports writer and author of 100 Things Lions Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die, published by Triumph Books in 2012. And we're talking about some Lions draft picks, some famous, some infamous players throughout the decades, as we approach the NFL draft week here in April. Let's go from three of the worst Matt Millen draft picks to what you call, Paula, the best seventh-round draft pick ever, perhaps.
Yes.
Some fans may remember him from well over a generation ago. That's the prototype middle linebacker Joe Schmidt.
Lou Carpenter tries to turn the right flank. The Lions all-pro linebacker Joe Schmidt lays Lou low for a three-yard loss.
Joe Schmidt. He imposes his will. And Jim Brown, who's the greatest, had a very bad day.
Right. He kind of defined that middle linebacker position, because the 4-3 was just coming into play more back then. It had been the 3-4. So he's kind of known as the man that kind of created that middle linebacker position. And he was a seventh-round draft pick in 1953. He had played college ball at Pittsburgh, but he'd been injured a lot. So apparently no one wanted to, you know, take a chance on him in earlier rounds.
Mm-hmm.
But he played 13 seasons. He was Defensive Player of the Year 4 times. He was team captain 9 years. Back in 1999, the Sporting News ranked him the 65th best all-time player in the NFL. And he was Pro Bowl 10 straight years. I mean, he was everything. And the Lions, he came in 53, and the Lions won championships in 53 and 57. And they said one of his strengths was he was really, really good at reading opposing offenses.
Zeke Gronkowski connects with Willie Gallimore in the right flat, but a vicious tackle by Gary Lowe jars the ball loose. Joe Schmidt picks it up at the 14, dribbles once, and goes in to score for Detroit.
We're going to stay roughly in the Joe Schmidt era, maybe a little more recently, for another one of the great defensive players in Lions history.
Friends and family and educators alike told me I could never be a professional ball player because I was too small. I'd be too slow, I'd get creamed, I'd get smashed, think about doing something else, and I would come home crying to my mom and dad, and they would always tell me, don't ever fight back at a person when they tell you you can't do something you really want to do in your heart, but let it be every time they tell you you can't do it, let it be like they're putting an extra gallon of gas in your tank to help you to achieve your goals. So by the time I got to Detroit in 1967, I was full of gas.
That's Lem Barney, who was drafted out of a school, Jackson State University, a smaller school, but certainly not a stranger to great players. I think Walter Payton was a Jackson State draft
right,
pick
not
long after that.
And Lem Barney, he told a story. His first game for the Lions, he had an interception and he returned it for a touchdown.
Yeah.
And his thought was, wow, this is going to be kind of easy. Well, he found out it wasn't going to be quite that easy. But in his career, he had 56 interceptions, which in 11 seasons. So, I mean, that's still a very impressive number. Lem was, he must have been impressive in college because he was a second-round pick for the Lions.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, Hall of Famer, just at cornerback for 11 seasons. I mean, you know, these days, cornerback is always an issue. When Len Barney was playing, it was not an issue. He was the guy there. He played 11 seasons. So, and he was a 7-time Pro Bowler, which is, you know, pretty amazing.
There's so much breadth and depth and history in your book, 100 Things Lions Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. I want to go back even farther to a player that I didn't really know that much about, and maybe not too many younger Lions fans, and that's Yale Larry. And this is chapter 77 of your book, which you entitled Totally Multidimensional. Tell us about Yale Larry.
Well, some people think he was the best punter in the game back in those days, and maybe, you know, I don't want to say forever, but he was one of the best punters in the game. But he also played defensive back, and he was also a kick returner. So he should have drawn three salaries. I'm sure he didn't, but he excelled at all of them. And so much so, he is so remembered that at the end of every season, the Lions give out a Special Teams Player of the Year award, and it's named for Yale Larry. So the Lions have not forgotten him and his contributions.
Lou Prosser comes forward and slams the opening kickoff high and deep into Detroit territory. Yale Larry takes it right on the goal line and comes back up the middle of the field for 20 yards.
You point out, Paula, that Larry won punting titles in 59, 61, and 63. And what happened in 1962? You said he missed it by 3.6 inches.
Yeah. Can you imagine having a punter be the defensive back and kick returner? I mean, he was drafted in 52, and the Lions won the championship again in 52, 53, and 57. He was there for all three of those. So he also, as a defensive back, had 50 interceptions in his career. So there's a lot of – too bad that some Lions fans just aren't aware of the history, because there's such a rich history of such good players.
The book is called 100 Things Lions Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. The author's Paula Pasch. Paula, thanks so much for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
It's Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. Voices across Michigan, from Governor Rick Snyder's to thousands of ordinary citizens, are calling for improvements to the state's transportation infrastructure. One Lansing-based policy organization, Transportation for Michigan, is promoting that discussion. Transform, as it's called, is actually a coalition of diverse groups focusing on funding, as well as on projects that often involve non-motorized transportation. Current State welcomes Transform's coordinator, Catherine Gray. Thanks for coming in.
Hello, thank you.
You told me in a recent conversation that transportation in Michigan is not working. What's not working?
Well, I think, you know, transportation in Michigan has a long way to go. One, obviously, right now, roads and bridges is a big piece. We know that the current infrastructure is not cannot be maintained with the current revenue dollars. But I think there's a bigger discussion there, which is, you know, we have to plan for the future. And even right now, we have young people leaving the state. We have seniors who can't drive. And we don't have alternative modes of transportation for them. And we've got to figure that out. So, you know, I think to a certain extent, it's working for certain parts of the population. But as we may talk about, residents don't feel it's working completely.
You alluded to funding, though, but funding is a huge, huge piece of this puzzle. Where the money is going to come from to maintain roads and bridges. Where is the future? Does your group take a position as to where the future of important funding should come from?
Well, I think we all know that we've got to come up with funding somewhere. The governor said in his budget proposal that he wanted to raise an additional $1.2 billion.
Yeah.
Currently, the legislature is, you know, discussing whether this would come from a gas tax, a wholesale tax, sales tax.
Fee hikes.
Yep, registration fees. There's all sorts of different options. And right now, the legislature, if you talk to a legislator, they're going to say, we all know that we need more money. The question is how we get it. So I don't think one has come to the surface within the legislature. But our group definitely knows.
How big a concern is that, though, since it is so dependent on revenue?
It's a big concern. You know, we we need to, as citizens, really tell our elected officials, we need you to figure this out. We need you to come to a compromise on what funding might look like, because we can't afford to wait anymore. And Director Steitel from MDOT said that. We can't afford to wait until next year's budget cycle to figure out where transportation funding revenues come from. We've got to figure it out. We've got to ante up and figure out, are there cuts that can be made, or do we just, you know, figure out a fee or a tax to make this happen?
Does someone in your organization, is there a consensus view in your organization as to how the public feels about how to fund, how to come up with $1 billion for transportation?
Well, when we did our community forums last summer, you know, a lot of legislators will say, I have my town hall meetings and people don't want to raise taxes. They don't want to do that. But, you know, we had 18 community forums where we had almost 500 people in attendance, and they're saying we're willing to pay because we want alternative modes of transportation. And so I think several of our organizations have talked about the various proposals, whether it's a sales tax or a registration fee. I think there's concerns with all of them, but there's also a great pros to all of them, and that's where we've got to come to a compromise on it.
Okay. Who are some of the key members of your coalition?
Some of our key members are the Michigan Environmental Council, the Michigan Municipal League, Transportation Riders United, Michigan Suburbs Alliance. We've got disability advocate groups, some faith-based organizations. So we've got some key members, as well as the Michigan Chamber.
Is your group then more involved in the funding discussion, or are you more involved in non-motorized transportation issues?
I would say at this point, one of our current priorities is the funding discussion, because that affects non-motorized. And that, you know, if we don't get the funding right, there will not be funding for non-motorized. So we've kind of got to make sure we do that first, and then we can start working on the non-motorized piece. But we do work on complete streets and making sure that happens.
You alluded a minute ago to these 18 forums that you conducted across the state of Michigan last summer, where you asked what Michigan citizens want in the way of transportation. Was the major takeaway then what you mentioned just a minute ago? Was it the fact that the public is more willing to spend tax and fee dollars on improving transportation than might be perceived?
Yeah.
There is a greater willingness amongst the public to actually ante up and improve transportation.
Correct. Yeah, I think that, you know, we found if you go to, we have a report online and it shows, you know, current MDOT budget spending 90% on roads and bridges, which they have to constitutionally by Public Act 51. But residents are saying we want more of our budget to be spent on rail, buses, bike paths, those things that are considered non-motorized or public transportation options. And they're willing to talk about ways that we can do this, whether it's local transportation options, public millages, things like that in their own local communities as well, if the state won't ante up. But it's important that the state work as well.
What is the mandate of Public Act 51? It assigns a number to how many transportation tax dollars go to roads and bridges?
It doesn't assign a specific number, but there's a funding formula, just like any other department, and that funding formula allocates a certain percentage to roads and bridges. And within our formula, about it, that comes out to about roughly 90% that is working on maintaining or updating, reconstructing our current roads and bridges system. So that leaves little left for public transportation options. Non-motorized, so our trails and things like that, are about 1% of the total budget.
So does that, those ratios need to be changed in your view?
Yeah, we, you know, as a coalition, we're working on that. We do believe that the funding formula has to change, but we also want to make sure that we get funding revenues up. So, you know, there are some organizations who feel like, we need this funding formula changed now. Some are willing to wait maybe till next year so that we can at least get funding revenues up and then talk about how can we reallocate this budget.
So do you pick up a divide somewhere between the legislature and the public, or between agencies like MDOT and the public? Is there a disconnect there?
I think MDOT is very aware of how the public feels. You know, Director Steitel has done several presentations where, you know, he's talking about exactly what the residents are saying. I think the legislators don't want to be the ones to raise taxes. And I think it is a very tough position for them to be in. You know, we've got this huge deficit in gap in our transportation system, and they've got to figure out a way to do it. And, you know, really, there are going to be some of their constituents who don't want it. There are going to be some of their constituents who want it. And it's one of those really tough decisions that they're going to have to make. But in the end, I think everybody knows we need it.
We're talking with Catherine Gray, who's the coordinator of TRANSFORM, which is an acronym for Transportation for Michigan. That is a coalition of groups that is participating in the discussion here in the state over transportation infrastructure, how to pay for it, what should matter. Where is the future, Catherine, in terms of non-motorized transportation? Where's the biggest bang for the buck when it comes to non-motorized?
Well, I think the biggest bang for the buck is trails, bike paths, those types of things. As I said, we've got youth that are leaving the state of Michigan to go to places where these amenities are happening. They're present in everyday life, urban core cities, and we've got to make sure that we have these options available. So, you know, non-motorized has got to be at the forefront of people's minds, especially for seniors. Seniors are not going to be able to drive. And I think about that with my parents. Are they living in a community where, you know, I don't have to go to them every single day to take them to their medical appointments, take them to their grocery stores, because they have a walkable, accessible community with non-motorized infrastructure there.
Are there communities in Michigan that are really good examples of where non-motorized options are really taking shape and really taking off?
I think there are several communities who are working towards it. Traverse City is a great place where the walkability is great. They've got this huge grand vision that they're working on because they know it's important. They've got different groups, economic groups, all types of groups working on this. You know, Grand Rapids, they're becoming much more of a walkable community, and it's helping their downtown life, their economic life. It's bringing businesses in, and it's bringing conferences in, and it's especially important in Michigan where our tourist is at. I mean, people, how to come here from a different state and then realize, oh, I've got to drive everywhere.
Uh-huh. Remind our listeners what the Complete Streets initiative is and how that fits into this discussion.
Yeah, Complete Streets is really a way that we design our communities in such that it's accessible for all users. So we have, sidewalks that are accessible. We have students that can use the transportation network, young kids, seniors, youth, and it might include bike paths. It might include specific truck routes, so that the truckers are not on the same thoroughfare that people should be walking. You see that a lot in the Detroit area. You know, you've got these big 8 Mile or Gratiot or Woodward where you've got a lot of heavy traffic, but it's also the main place where people walk, and that's not safe. So we've got to figure out, you know, how can we make our streets complete, in essence?
Right. Accessible and usable by more than just motorized transportation.
Correct.
That is the heart of it. Okay. Transportation for Michigan, or TRANSFORM, is a grant-funded coalition. Who provided the grants?
We have different grants provided by Kresge, Ford, and Mott.
Okay. And how long are you funded for?
We're funded for a three-year time span, and then we'll look at other grant options after that.
There was one thing from the news this morning that I wanted to run by you when I knew we were going to have this conversation. Out of Ypsilanti Township, a proposal for a $919 million elevated rail system is among the ideas for reusing the site of a former GM plant in Ypsilanti Township. Justin Sutton with the Interstate Traveler Company. Are you familiar with them by any chance?
I am not.
Okay. Justin Sutton, Interstate Traveler Company, says he wants to use the former Willow Run powertrain plant to build components and rail cars. The proposal would connect Willow Run Airport to the Detroit Metropolitan Airport. This is obviously not non-motorized transportation, but is this the kind of thing that's on your radar too?
Yeah, I mean, high-speed rail is really important, and we heard that from our community forums too. People want rail because, you know, how great is it to be able to travel an hour and a half, 3 hours on a train when you can work, you can read, you can listen to music, and not drive? And that gets people off the roads. Michigan is looking at high-speed rail options, between Detroit and Chicago. We've got some corridors, and we have the manufacturing base to really, design some of these high-speed rail components as well.
Are you encouraged by the this discussion involving rail in Southeast Michigan? That seems to be moving along.
Yes, the M1 rail corridor, yeah. Woodward Ave, all of those, they're having a lot of public meetings right now. And I think that if you look into the future, you look at New York, look at Chicago, they've got these, whether it's bus rapid transit, high-speed rail, they've got these pieces of infrastructure, and they're appealing to people. And we need to figure out how are we going to make that happen in Detroit.
Catherine Gray is coordinator for the Lansing-based policy organization Transportation for Michigan, promoting the discussion over funding for transportation and non-motorized transportation as well. Catherine, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
A notable Lansing area choir is observing its 50th anniversary this year. The Earl Nelson Singers are celebrating half century of spirituals with a concert in downtown Lansing on Monday. WKAR's Melissa Benmark checked in with the director of the group and her husband, who's a member, for some of their musical memories.
My name is Verna Holly, and I have been in the group since 1975. Two or 73, I can't really remember exactly, but we came to Lansing in 1970, and we were looking for things to do, groups to align ourselves with, and we found out about the Nelson Singers, and we both joined that group, and we've been with it ever since. When I first joined, I was a singer. Then later on, I became the accompanist, and then later on after that, I became the director. So it's been a fun journey, and working with the group has been a real plus in my life.
I'm Melvin Holly. I'm a bass, and of course, we've been with the group since late 1972, and it has been a joy because I come from a family of singers. We met a friend, teacher, by the name of Rosetta West, and she was insistent, you must be a part of the group. And we sought to join, and at that time they had an auditioning process, and nobody called us to tell us whether we were in or not, and so we didn't go back until the next time we saw Rosetta, and she really, get back there. And so that's how we happened to be a part for so many years.
What are your thoughts on having something like that be a part of your life for that many years? What does it feel like to you? Is it comfort? Is it something to look forward to? What are your thoughts?
It's a comfort to me, and sometimes the words of the songs just come into my mind, sometimes in the middle of the night, sometimes in the middle of the day. I love the harmony. I think that was created because I was in my high school choir, and we sang four-part classical literature. We did not sing spirituals that I can recall, but we sang the Handel Messiah and works similar to that. And so it created a real desire for me to continue singing this wonderful harmony, and the Nelson Singers certainly fulfilled that. We sing the classical arrangements of the spirituals, and most of them are arranged to fit the mood or the text of the spiritual. And so that is certainly a real plus with me. Sometimes the spirituals are made fun of or jazzed up that do not really fit the song appropriately. But that has been fulfilling for me. And it's a real comfort.
Made fun of in what way?
Many of the spirituals use a dialect that is similar to the way we as a people learn language. That's one of the reasons why sometimes it's thought of as funny. Funny also in the sense that fun can be made of, why do you sing in dialect and not in precise English. Well, we weren't exposed to precise English and in learning it. That's one of the reasons why we think of the Nelson Singers as a large family. We are a multicultural group and made up of singers, those who are accomplished singers, as well as those who are bathtub singers. And so sometimes we have to work with that. And we've found that to be the thing that is kind of the glue for all of us.
Even the closest family sometimes will get on each other's nerves a little bit. Do you sometimes think, maybe this is too long to be singing?
I don't think so. Matter of fact, we just lost a man who I stood next to, sang with, since 1972. He passed away last year. And it has been quite an adjustment for me. Because I could tell his breathing patterns. I knew when he would run out of breath as he, of course, he was older than I, so I'm so young. But it was a joy to be next to him all of those years. And he had been at the group with the group since about 1968. So many of the things that I learned within the group sort of patterned him. If he sang, I sang. If he didn't sing, I didn't sing. I didn't make any sound at all. And we find others, when they find a group and would like to sing with the Nelson Singers, it's a learning pattern. Some people are frightened away because, well, we know all of these songs, and they have to learn them. And sometimes it's overwhelming. But as in any family, we learn. Yeah.
The group was formed during a time of a lot of adversity in the country. My understanding is that the first concert of the Earl Nelson Singers was a couple days after the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And there have been a lot of times of adversity since then. Singing is so personal. Have there been times when you've gone into a rehearsal and looked at each other and said, we're going to sing something else because we can't sing what we're supposed to be practicing right now? It's just too much.
Well, there are varying songs. For instance, on our concert that's coming up next Monday, we are singing a song called A City Called Heaven. And the text is, sometimes I am tossed and driven. Sometimes I don't know where to go. I've heard of A City Called Heaven, and that phrase alone kind of gives you a lift. It gives you hope. And so our repertoire is varied. Sometimes they're songs of sorrow. I've been buked and I've been scorned. I've been talked about, show as you born. But then the final stanza says, ain't gonna lay my religion down. And so there is hope in spite of how I've been treated or how I view my situation. We sing a variety of moods, and that helps.
I understand that Earl Nelson is coming back from Florida for the 50th anniversary celebration.
Yes, he has agreed to come, and he's excited about it. And, of course, he's very pleased that, you know, we still use his name for the name of the group. And he will be directing some of the pieces that he was doing when he was the director, and also will talk a little bit about how the group got started. So we're looking forward to it, and we expect it to be a gala occasion, and it should be one of a kind.
Do you have any memories of singing under Earl Nelson?
Earl, as he would characterize the particular song by telling the scriptural story and forgot to tell the group what song he was talking about. And he turned and gave the downbeat, and not a sound came out of the choir because no one knew what song are we going to sing. And that's a fun way to remember.
What did you do?
Nothing. We stood there, and he gave the downbeat, and not a sound came out of any of the singers' mouths because they didn't know what song. And he recovered by telling us we're going to sing this particular song. And, of course, he turned to tell the audience as well, you know. So we were trained.
Melvin Holly is a longtime member of the Earl Nelson Singers. We also heard from his wife, Verna Holly, who directs the group. They spoke with WKAR's Melissa Benmark. Monday's concert is at 7:30 at First Presbyterian Church in Lansing. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we welcome chef and writer Maureen Aboud. She discusses Lebanese food and her blog, Rosewater and Orange Blossoms. That and more coming up on Current State Friday. Current State's executive producer is Peter Worf. Our producer is Joe Lindstroff. Thanks to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, Yensia Wong, and Sonia Treweiler for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.